While you were listening to this cool hip jazz music, I was chatting with Sandra Gilbert. After I put her on hold so that she could hear her introduction, I told my producer, or I just spoke out loud, "Sandra Gilbert, I just love this woman." And then he asked, my producer did, "Really? Sometimes I can't be sure," suggesting that I'm eternally sarcastic, like, say, David Letterman or what have you. But no, it's earnest, because Sandra Gilbert, as I mentioned earlier, is one of my literary and creative heroes. And for good reason. She was formerly a mentor of mine and also a colleague as a professor of English at the University of California, Davis, where she taught for many years and where she is now professor emerita. She's the author of 20 books, more than 20 books, including 8 collections of poetry. She's taught at a great number of universities, including Stanford and Princeton, and is recognized as one of the most accomplished feminist literary scholars and theorists of our time. In addition to her works of poetry, she's published a memoir, an anthology of elegies, a critical study called Rereading Women, 30 Years of Exploring Our Literary Traditions, which just came out last year from Norton. Her most recent volume of poems, Aftermath, was also published by Norton in 2011. When I was on the job market, she was awarded the presidency of the Modern Language Association. And as a result of her longtime collaboration with Susan Gubar, who's a professor of English at Indiana University, they were both named as a Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year, as well as in USA Today's People Who Made a Difference. She's received a great number of fellowships, including from Rockefeller, NEH, Soros Foundation, Guggenheim, and she's held residencies at Yaddo, McDowell, and Bellagio, among others. In 1990, she was with Carl Shapiro, also a former professor of poetry at UC Davis, a co-recipient of the International Poetry Forum's Charity Randall Award. And more recently, she's won a Patterson Prize and an American Book Award for her marvelous book of poetry, Kissing the Bread and Ghost Volcano, respectively. Sandra Gilbert divides her time between Berkeley and Paris, but tomorrow she'll be coming to Davis to read as part of the Poetry Night reading series here in the city of Davis at the John Atsoulis Gallery. That's at 8 o'clock at 521 First Street. More information at poetryindavis.com, but the best information you'll find out right now as I introduce all of you to Sandra Gilbert. Sandra, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Andy. I'm thrilled to join you. I can hardly recognize myself in your glowing testimonial, but I hope something is true of it.
Oh, so much of it is. And as I hear your voice, I'm remembering that not only have we had conversations and have I seen your performances here in Davis, but also in Berkeley and in Washington, D.C., and even in Stirling, Scotland, if you remember that back in the
day. Stirling, right. That was a wonderful event.
I really enjoyed
it. It was marvelous.
And we got to chat with some Nobel laureates, including Seamus Heaney. And
right.
It was an enjoyable half week of poetry, both performance and analysis.
Yes, it was wonderful. So consider, Dr. Andy, we've been around the world together.
We sure have. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm so glad that you'll be coming back to Davis tomorrow evening.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to it.
You've been a professor emerita of UC Davis for a number of years, and I mentioned that you divide your time between Berkeley and Paris. What's your attitude towards your ongoing responsibility to both creative writing and to scholarship and essays in the years since you left full-time professoring at UC Davis?
Well, first I just want to make one thing clear, and that is that I no longer divide my time between Berkeley and Paris. My Paris life came to an end when the man with whom I lived in Paris died in 2008. Mm. And in fact, my new book, Aftermath, he was a mathematician, is a memory of him. It's a volume dedicated to his memory, and I will probably read from it. We had a wonderful time in Paris, but, you know, as all good things do, that those years came to an end, but there were 15 wonderful years in the Marais. And now I live in Berkeley and spend some time also at the Sea Ranch, not a bad deal. You'll agree.
And sure.
I'm perfectly happy with it. I still write. I finished Aftermath. I wrote I compiled Rereading Women, which is a collection of essays of mine. And in 2006, I published a book called Death's Door, Modern Dying and the Ways We Grieve, which is partly memoiristic and partly cultural studies. But I always write poetry while I'm doing all my other writing.
Right.
And at the moment, I'm working on a book which is nearly finished to be titled The Culinary Imagination, How and Why We Read, Write, Work, and Play with Food in the 21st Century.
Oh, that's wonderful. You always come up with the most interesting topics. You know, some of our former colleagues at UC Davis would often work on a variation of a familiar theme. But I've really appreciated the ways that you moved in different directions with your collections of essays and with your anthologies. And I'm sure some of that comes from the fact that you have freedom because of your prominence, that people are really interested with the different projects that you're working on. And I'm sure this book about food writing will be the same way.
Well, it's very exciting, although it's also very exciting to be nearing the end of it. I just finished writing a long chapter about culinary novels, but I have written about a lot of other stuff, about, food memoirs and about glamorous chefs and strange foods and the powers of the kitchen. And I have only one more chapter to go, which I think is going to be about food and politics, or what I'll call food fights. And I hope that'll be that.
And food fights is a terrific title. I'm wondering if you could say something as a poet and as a scholar about some of the titles of your own scholarly works, and also the works that you've done with Susan Gubar, because I think the titles are both insightful, but also descriptive of those books in ways that you might expect from a poet.
Oh, thank you. The luckiest title was The Mad Woman in the Attic, because it nearly was a different title, and it would have been very, very stupid in comparison with The Mad Woman. I think that what happened was Susan and I were going to co-teach a course back in the increasingly feminist 1970s. We were then at Indiana University, and I said, why don't we call it Upstairs, Downstairs, because we were thinking about the distinction between women's lives in the parlor and in the kitchen, or between women in the attic and women in the parlor. And she said, that's really awful. So, and it was, because Upstairs, Downstairs was a, big television hit, but
sure.
It would have been a kind of vulgar title for The Mad Woman. And so I think I just pathetically suggested The Mad Woman in the Attic, because I was so obsessed with Bertha Mason Rochester, The Mad Woman in Jane Eyre.
Right.
And so that was a lucky title, because it was a lucky escape. But you don't always get the title you want. I wanted to call Rereading Women Mother Writes, R-I-T-E-S, but obviously with a pun on W-R-I-T-E-S.
Right.
And my editor just wasn't having it. She said, it won't be clear to people. They'll think it's a book about maternity. They won't let you, it's just going to get in the wrong shelf. It's not going to get in the right shelf in the Barnes & Noble.
Right.
And so she decided to call it Rereading Women, which is okay, but not what I wanted. On the other hand, I published a book of poems once called Blood Pressure, and they were, in fact, pressuring me about that, because they said, oh, this is going to sound like a medical textbook. And I said, well, it doesn't look like a medical textbook. It's going to look like a book of poems. The way books of poems are thin and shiny and don't look like medical textbooks.
Right.
And so finally they gave in. I think it just didn't matter to them. It wasn't that important, because it was, after all, only a book of poems. I was happy with that.
But also No Man's Land was a terrific title.
I love that.
And almost a triple pun, as I learned from classes from you in the early 90s, because it makes us think about the place where you don't want to be, say, during World War I.
Right.
but also this idea of how, say, for instance, when T.S. Eliot was publishing his poetry, that it was more women such as Edna St. Vincent Millay who were really setting the poetry world on fire.
Right.
And in some ways it was a no man's land, at least when it came to poetry book sales.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. In fact, not just poetry books, but for quite some time, novels, women were the authors of best-selling novels. And some male writers actually adopted women's names to sell their books. So the world, for a while, felt to men like a no-man's land or, as we might also put it, a her land.
Right, absolutely.
That was what, you know. Now, that was a title we actually, I mean, of course, that's a famous territory. It's a terrain in the First World War. No Man's Land, but there was at least one other book named No Man's Land, and I remember feeling quite guilty because I loved that book. It was a wonderful historical study of the war, of the Great War, but we just felt that we had to use it too.
I think so, and it worked out well. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sandra Gilbert, and she's one of the most prominent professors ever to teach in the English department at the University of California at Davis. And she is also a creative writer, author of a great number of well-celebrated books of poetry. And she'll be reading tomorrow evening at the John Itzulis Gallery as part of the Poetry Night reading series. Now, Sandra, when we were speaking before we went on the air, I forgot to ask you to grab a book of poetry to see if there's something that you could read to give folks a taste of what they might enjoy tomorrow.
Oh, it's all right. I have two here. And maybe I'll read, maybe I'll try to, this is a kind of food or non-food poem, and it's from Aftermath, but it's a political poem, too. It's from a series of poems that I wrote called Materia Medica. And this one is called, I'm just trying to find the page, Colonoscopy Sonnet. You may or may not remember that during the presidency of George W. Bush, our president had a colonoscopy.
Right.
And it was a real big deal. Everybody was anxious because, well, he was under the whatever you go under when you have a colonoscopy. Then Dick Cheney, the vice president, was in charge of everything. So I wrote a sonnet about that as part of my series of medical sonnets.
Excellent. Let's hear it.
Okay. Colonoscopy sonnet. On the news tonight, a presidential colonoscopy. A tale of how for 3 whole hours the chief exec of trouble handed trouble to his vice, although no double trouble came. But then no more details revealed. No bacterial armies multiplying in a flare of war among kingly polyps and no kinky creases. Welcome to the presidential gut, bubblegum pink, not a spot of shit, where global decisions stir and sit in state, and the first physician's mighty pointer traces only micro drops of blood in secret places.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love the word tale in about line 3, because it's a tale of a tale, I guess, if you will.
Yes, thank you. Anyway, it seems appropriate since we're coming up to this terrifying election, so.
It is terrifying, and normally we don't delve into political topics, but we're coming up on the end of our time, and I'm wondering if you have any reflections on how people might vote or what you see as an important thing at stake with regard to the presidential election Tuesday.
I think what's at stake is the health of the American people, the health and welfare of the American people. I think it's very important that people should be able to get health insurance without having to be, you know, even if they have pre-existing conditions. My work on death and dying has meant that I've done quite a lot of work on medicine and, of course, writing about food and issues having to do with food. You also think about matters like that. So So I actually think this is a crucial election, and it's very frightening. I hope everybody who has a chance will go out and vote. I frankly am not too worried about California, but if you know people in other states like Ohio, please tell them to go vote and vote the right way.
Absolutely.
Which is the left way.
Well, Sonia Gobin, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. I'm looking forward to speaking of food writing, chatting about food and other topics over dinner tomorrow, and then enjoying your reading at 8 o'clock at the John Natsoulis Gallery right here in the city of Davis at 1st and E Streets.
Wonderful. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, Andy.
Same here. Travel safely, and I'll see you tomorrow evening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.